come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. On this week's PreserveCast, we're talking with Paul Cousson, the Director of Government Relations at the American Battlefield Trust, about Boots on the Ground, a manual for battlefield friends groups. Paul walks us through how the manual aims to provide resources for friends groups, new and established, who serve at the first line of defense against potential threats to our American heritage on these hallowed grounds. All that and more about the American Battlefield Trust on this week's PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding, and you're listening to PreserveCast. We're excited today to be joined by Paul Cousson, who is the Director of Government Relations with the American Battlefield Trust. And we're going to be talking all about a new publication that they've put out that we think has a lot of value for preservationists, both inside the battlefield preservation community and outside, for that matter. It's called Boots on the Ground, a manual for battlefield friends groups. But it really provides a lot of insight and value for people, as I said, all around the preservation community. But before we get there, we want to get to know the person that we're talking with. So, Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up? What was the spark moment about getting into this line of work? And what was your first job in the field? How did it all come together?
Yeah, Nick, thanks for having me. Good to be on with you. I'm originally from South Louisiana, LSU grad, went to University of Georgia for grad school, and I actually studied political science, political communication. So I don't have that history background. But growing up, you know, my parents were history minded. They'd take my brother and I to historic sites all over Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas. First national parks I went to were Gulf Islands and Vicksburg. So I, at an early age, I had an appreciation for this stuff. And so after grad school, I moved up to D.C., working for my congressman from South Louisiana as his press secretary. And on the weekends, just to get out of town, I'd do what I did in Georgia, get on the road and, you know, go out, visit Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania, Gettysburg, Monocacy, Antietam. You know, these were the first times I visited these really incredible historic sites. And after a while on the Hill, I decided it was time to look elsewhere, put my skills that I acquired there to good use elsewhere. And Nick, it was kind of happenstance that you decided to head out of the trust, because when your spot opened up, as Nick, you were state and local government relations associate, I applied for that and effectively became the new Nick.
That's right.
Moniker that took, what, a year or two to shed finally, because you certainly left a legacy at the trust, a good one. But, you know, I've been at the trust for 11 years now and wouldn't still be there if I didn't love the work that I do and that we do. But started off, like I said, doing state and local government work, moved on to the federal side of things, and I'm effectively the federal lobbyist for battlefield preservation with the trust. And I've been doing that for quite a while now. We work closely with members of Congress and the various administrations to promote battlefield preservation, make sure there's robust funding for battlefield preservation initiatives, whether it's at the local side, the American Battlefield Protection Program, funds available for nonprofit groups like the trust to go out and purchase unprotected battlefield land. And then on the Park Service side, to make sure that there's funding available when land is available inside a national park boundary, that the park can go out and acquire the land. So it's certainly a fun, challenging, interesting job. And like I said, I've been there for 11 years now and wouldn't still be there if I didn't love the work that we do. So
it might be valuable for people. I mean, I know you're describing the work, but like maybe put the American Battlefield Trust in a little bit of context, you know, for people who are listening, who maybe deal more with the built environment and aren't as familiar with landscape preservation and that kind of stuff. Like a lot of people listening, because I've heard this, I used to work there, I know this. I thought all the battlefields were preserved by the National
Right.
Park Service, that kind of stuff. And so what was the impetus and what should people know about American Battlefield Trust? Like, what is the work and what are you guys, what's the scale of what you've done? What are you working on now?
Absolutely. Yeah. Altogether, the trust has preserved about 56,000 acres of battlefield land. And that's over about 30 years that we've been doing the work. And what kind of got the trust started, like you said, Nick, you know, a lot of land has been preserved. You think of Gettysburg, Antietam, Manassas, the big battlefields that everyone knows about. Most folks assume that's where the Civil War took place, or Yorktown, that's where the Revolutionary War took place. It's all protected. It's all saved. It's all interpreted. It turns out, no, that's not the case. Over time, a lot of the key battlefields that had not received that same level of attention early on from veterans, from the national parks, from Congress, right after the battles and right after the wars, you know, they were lost to time. A lot of them were developed, paved over around the late 80s, early 90s. There was a movement that took place that really reignited the battlefield preservation movement. Ken Burns' The Civil War came out. Battle Cry of Freedom was published. Gettysburg in 1993, Glory in 1989. Just got the public thinking about these places and these sites. And a group of like-minded battlefield enthusiasts came together and created a nonprofit organization to go out and, where there was unprotected battlefield land, preserve it before it was lost to time. So you have places like Brandy Station in Virginia, huge chunks of Monocacy in Maryland, South Mountain. A lot of these places, not much land had been preserved. There were opportunities to go in and acquire from willing landowners land that had not been preserved and interpreted. And so groups like the Trust got their start around that time. And the way we work is when a landowner lives on what's been identified as core battlefield, we work with them when they're ready to sell or want to part with their land. We encourage them to preserve it. We'll pay fair market value to purchase it. And if there is a state park or a local park, in some cases a national park, we'll transfer the land preserved to those entities for further preservation and interpretation. And it's, like I said, it's resulted in 56,000 acres of land preserved. I don't know, even places like Antietam, that you think, you know, it's far enough away from really developed areas. The original plan for that the Park Service had developed was just, let's just purchase the right of ways along all the roads through the Antietam battlefields, assuming no one's ever going to develop the farmland in between these roads. Well, as it turns out, as people move out, development will follow. And the Park Service did eventually realize we need to acquire this land so that it's preserved, not just, you know, the roads along the battlefield land, but the actual land itself. And so we've been, along with Preservation Maryland, working to preserve different parts of these battlefields in Antietam, in Monocacy, in South Mountain, and everywhere else around the country where battles of the Civil War, Revolutionary War, and War of 1812 took place.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction too, because I think a lot of people probably, if they're familiar with the work, they know about the Civil War battlefield preservation, but obviously it's expanded to the War of 1812, the Revolutionary War. Have you done any French and Indian?
Not yet. The mandate, so I mentioned the American Battlefield Protection Program. This is a federally authorized program. It has wide bipartisan support, which is great. That it's a matching grant program that groups like the Trust, other nonprofits use to go out and purchase. It's a federal, a one-to-one match. So the federal government will put up half of the cost. We will put up the other half. And it's a program that's certainly worked, and it's been used to save about 36,000 acres of that 56,000 acres that we've saved. But without that, you know, it would make that preservation process a lot tougher. So we certainly appreciate the support from members of Congress all over the country, and in particular Maryland. Maryland has a very strong preservation-minded congressional delegation.
Ben Cardin has been one of the strongest voices for preservation on all different fronts. And people on the built environment side know him as normally the standard champion and standard bearer for the historic tax credit, but he's also been very supportive of the land conservation issues. We're going to, Ben is retiring, so there's some big preservation shoes to fill there. So,
absolutely.
Speaking of preservation and this work, why do you care about friends groups?
So we see friends groups as the eyes and ears at these battlefields. You know, the trust is based out of Washington, D.C., and we've saved land in now 25 different states. So we can't be everywhere that we have saved land. Battlefields, national parks, you know, they're out obviously in the field. They see what goes on in their parks, but there's only so much that a superintendent can do. He has to follow, you know, the guidelines of the Park Services Directorate. So a friends group is a group of engaged, energetic folks at a location that are basically looking out for the battlefield, for the park, for the historic entity that's out there. And for us, having that, those eyes and ears on the grounds, whether they're, you know, Friends of Vicksburg down in Vicksburg, Mississippi, or, you know, the folks in Antietam, Save Historic Antietam Foundation, one of the best friends groups for a national park in the country. They're the folks who know what's going on. They see day to day if there's an issue that comes up, if there's land that could possibly be acquired, if the Park Service needs some kind of assistance in, you know, giving tours of a battlefield or having volunteers out there, or if there is a project, a restoration project, fence lines that need to be restored, the friends groups are kind of the go-to entity, not directly National Park Service or in some cases state government related, but kind of the eyes and ears on the ground who understand what needs to be done, what's going on at these sites, can get information back to the trust where we can help them. You know, they're probably the most valuable asset at these individual sites because they know what's going on. They get the needs of these different battlefields and can, you know, rally to an issue, get us involved, get the Park Service's attention. So it's for us, it's essential to have good, active nonprofit groups, these friends groups, these boots on the ground that can let us know information, get our attention on stuff that's important, keep the Park Service, you know, aware of things that are going on. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a group of folks in that community that care passionately about the park, about the battlefield. So having just a core group of people, of locals who get why this is important, who can advocate on behalf of the battlefield of the park, that goes such a long way.
Yeah, and sometimes they can say things that the Park Service wants to say but can't say. And, you know, we actually, interestingly, you know, Preservation Maryland, as most people know, powers PreserveCast, but we are actually the charitable partner, which is a fancy way of saying friends group, of the Historic Preservation Training Center of the National Park Service, which is based in Frederick, Maryland. So we know this story inside and out. When I saw this, I was like, oh, this is really cool. We have a unique relationship because our park partner is not a traditional park. They don't, you know, they don't tell stories and things like that. They restore and train and do some really amazing stuff. And we've done a previous episode with Moss Redley, the superintendent over there, if people want to listen to that one. But talk to us about the manual. So if someone's listening and they are a battlefield friends group, or they want to start a battlefield friends group, or they're a friends group of a national park that's not a battlefield, but want to think through like best practices and how they can improve their work, what does the manual cover? Where can people get it? We know why the friends groups matter. So what does the manual tell them about?
Yeah. First off, you can find the manual on our website, battlefields.org. And, you know, we've heard from a lot of folks, and not every national park, not every battlefield park has a friends group. And we'd hear from time to time from folks at these places wanting to know how they can go about getting a friends group. Or we used to have an active friends group and it's died off. How can we get it restarted? And we'd try and put resources. In a few cases, we were able to work hand in hand with the park, with a group of local folks to create a friends group. And we kind of learned as we went, what are the steps needed to go about creating essentially a nonprofit organization that can act on behalf of a battlefield park. So we've worked with this project on this project for a couple of years to kind of piece together what goes into putting a friends group together. And that's where this manual came from. And hopefully folks will use it. You know, if they have an interest in creating a friends group, what are the steps needed to go about creating an entity to support these battlefield parks? And, you know, just skimming through it, I think the one thing that stood out to me that you need is people. And I know it's almost a no-brainer, but you can't have a friends group without friends. You can't have a group without individuals who care passionately about these sites. So the first step is finding leadership and finding membership, finding those folks who are interested about in the park, in the battlefield, and getting them involved, getting them to say, you know, in their free time, I want to go out and advocate or work for the nonprofit or the group to support the battlefield or the National Park Service site. And so that's a key step. If you have out there, you know, you're at a battlefield that you know doesn't have a friends group, and, you know, whether it's a local civil roundtable or, you know, the Chamber of Commerce or Tourism Board, and you've heard, you know, we have this park, we have this battlefield, but there's no support group for it. Talk to those folks, talk to other folks, see who else might be out there that's interested in maybe getting something together. And then, you know, in most cases, these are small nonprofits. So you'd need to start the process of filing the paperwork to become a 501c3. And that opens up the door to fundraising, to advocating for the group. If you're working with a national park, definitely make sure that you're in lockstep with the goals and the mission of the national park itself, because superintendents want to have an active and engaged friends group working with them on behalf of the park. But you want to make sure that if you're doing this, you're doing it, like I said, in lockstep with the national park. I know there's a brand new or a relatively new friends group down in Monocacy that just got started, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago. They've been very active advocating for the park, raising money for different projects, organizing volunteer activities, and really becoming a spokesperson or spokesgroup for the national park unit out there, the battlefield that's out there. And the trust has partnered with them to go out and work on various projects, look at additional land acquisition that can take place there. Same thing with Save Historic Antietam Foundation. We rely on these folks to know, is there land that could be acquired? Can we partner with them? Can we jointly apply for these ABPP grants if there's state money available? But we can't do our job unless we know what's going on down in these battlefields, whether it's in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, Virginia. So the more friends groups out there, the stronger advocates they are, the better the community of battlefield preservationists can do their job to save the land, interpret it, fight the threats as they come up, because a lot of times these friends groups will be the strongest advocates for the parks against harmful development that may be popping up next to the battlefields. And we've definitely seen that. So again, this manual, you know, we're very excited it's out there. We hope folks who are interested in creating a friends group for a battlefield take a look. You know, it, like I said, it lays out the steps, but start the conversations. That's the biggest thing. Start talking to people in the community. If you've heard from folks that are interested in starting a friends group, that's step one, you know, leadership and membership. Get that core group and dive right in. And like I said, the manual lays out all the steps from fundraising to getting to know the park entity, and then keeping the momentum going, because that's one thing. You create it and then keeping it going beyond.
I'm curious, has the trust ever thought about getting, or have they ever tried to pull together as many of the battlefield friends groups, even just virtually, to see how things are going across the country and to kind of create some cross-pollination? Because I'm sure, you know, it's always helpful to kind of see what other people are doing, yeah, or to feel that everybody else has sort of similar challenges.
Yeah, we've worked on a few locally. A couple of years ago, we did a pretty extensive friends group project with Virginia's Department of Historic Resources. We're working on one in Mississippi, just trying to collect all of the different friends groups out there. Because, you know, over time, some have been very involved, very engaged. I mentioned the Friends of Vicksburg. They're one of the best out there. There are others in the state that have kind of gone dormant. So we'd love to get them reengaged. So, you know, it's something we'd be definitely interested in convening at some point. You know, if there is an interest in creating a new friends group, you know, please reach out to us and anything we can do to help get that going. But yeah, having those bigger conversations, I think would be a huge next step once we, you know, see what's out there. Cause we're still, you know, in a lot of ways, learning who's active, learning who's not, who needs to kind of get a boost and kind of get a jump start on their friends group.
So why don't we take a quick pause, come back, and then talk a little bit just to sort of about some of the campaigns that the American Battlefield Trust is working on right now, and then how people can follow you and learn more about you.
Absolutely.
And we'll do that right here on PreserveCast. Historic preservation can't happen without skilled tradespeople to perform the work. And there's a critical need right now for those tradespeople. The Campaign for Historic Trades, powered by Preservation Maryland, is working to meet that need by strengthening apprenticeship opportunities within historic trades. In partnership with the National Park Service's Historic Preservation Training Center and Conservation Legacy, the campaign is currently recruiting for NPS Traditional Trades Apprenticeship Program, or TTAP. TTAP's an intensive 20-week apprenticeship that provides young adults the chance to learn historic trade skills while working on America's most iconic historic sites. Multiple positions are open for the 2022 season at national parks across the country. Visit historictrades.org for more information on TTAP and how to apply today. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast. Excited to be joined by Paul Cousson today. We've been talking all about the American Battlefield Trust, as well as this new manual that they have, Boots on the Ground, a manual for battlefield friends groups, which has, as we said, a lot of value, not only for battlefield friends groups, but for groups supporting preservation efforts in a lot of different ways, because it shows you sort of step by step how to get something like this off the ground. And as Paul knows, I was involved in one of these crazy startups with the Friends of the Manassas Battlefield, the Manassas Battlefield Trust, and it would have been really helpful to have had this handbook at the time. We were kind of making it up as we went.
Right.
So we know that they can find it on the American Battlefield Trust site. Beyond Boots on the Ground and this manual, what else should people know about the work of the Trust right now? Are you actively trying to save any battlefield land on battlefields that people might know about? And do you have, this is obviously a sort of a loaded question, I think I know the answer here. Are there any threats to battlefields right now?
Quite a few. First, yes, we are preserving land all over the country. I mentioned, you know, we've saved land in 25 different states. There are always new opportunities. We work with about 383 different Civil War battlefield sites identified by Congress in a manual they put together back in 1993, the Civil War Sites Advisory Commission report. So we know the landscape of battlefields that are out there. We know which ones are most endangered, which are most threatened, which have the best preservation opportunities. So over the years, we've gotten to know the landowners. And like I said, when something comes up, we try and work with them. If they're interested in selling, again, we only work with willing sellers to go out and purchase the land, put an easement on it, and then transfer it where we can to a state, local, national government entity. So we're doing a lot of work. There are a few projects we're working on at Antietam right now. There's always stuff going on at South Mountain. A lot of preservation opportunities out there. Across Pennsylvania, a lot of stuff in New York. We used to just be the Civil War Trust, previously the Civil War Preservation Trust. Congress expanded the American Battlefield Protection Program's mission to include Revolutionary War and War of 1812 sites. When they did that, they kind of asked us, would we expand our mission to do the same? And that's how we became the American Battlefield Trust, preserving Revolutionary War and War of 1812 sites in addition to Civil War. So on the Revolutionary War side, we've done quite a bit in South Carolina on something called the Liberty Trail, kind of connecting those lesser known Southern campaign sites of the Revolutionary War to get people out to these sites. So there's always something going on down there. We've done quite a bit of work up in New York State. Our only War of 1812 site to date has been Sackett's Harbor in New York, but we are looking at sites in and around Maryland. There's, of course, Fort McHenry. So there's an opportunity for preservation or interpretation there. We're definitely looking for opportunities. But in terms of threats, Nick, we've seen more threats in the last year to battlefields than we've seen in quite a long time.
Yeah, I was really surprised by just the scale of the threats. Yeah. I mean, we pay attention to what's going on all across the country, you know, and it ebbs and flows. And it seemed like for a while there, the focus of the trust really was just almost exclusively on land preservation, that there weren't these big advocacy battles. Obviously, I was involved in one, which we did a preserve cast on the Gettysburg Casino. And there was the Wilderness Walmart, and there was mining at Cedar Creek, and there were just these mega disastrous proposals. And then it seemed like they quieted down for a while. And then it seems like after the pandemic, they just came roaring back. And you've got all of this pressure of data centers, which everybody's seeing everywhere. You don't have to drive through any highway town, it seems like, now either has data centers or massive distribution warehouses. So you're seeing the proliferation of that. And then just these mega redevelopments, and the one at Wilderness, I think, has caught the eye regionally, just from like a Chesapeake Bay perspective of, oh my God, we're going to just rip up thousands of acres and build a giant sprawl town.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's a characterization. That's my opinion there. I'm not sure if that's the position of the trust, but boy, it does not seem like a good land use plan.
No, and we've seen, like you said, so many of these popping up all at the same time. Early 2021 was when we first got word of the Prince William Digital Gateway right outside Manassas. I mean, we're talking right across the street from the national park. The county is moving forward with a mega rezoning redevelopment with just a data center campus. And I'll stress this, the trust is not opposed to development, smart development. People need data centers. We need to be able to have these conversations that we're having right now, Nick.
Right.
You know, if not for these data centers, if not for having these places to store this information, this technology, we wouldn't be able to have this podcast.
But, right. But like all things, it's a matter of
location.
And, you know, the way we sort of approach things at Preservation Maryland, we have a whole smart growth program in the organization, and I know others across the country do as well, is that, you know, we've already ripped up a lot of land throughout the country, and redevelopment of existing places always seems like a smarter move than putting it on farmland. I remember the head of the Maryland Farm Bureau one time said about one issue, why is it that farmland has to be the place for every bad idea? And
because it's open land, you know, it's undeveloped.
Right. So talk to us. I mentioned the Wilderness one. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about the data centers at Manassas, but what is this crazy concept at the Wilderness? I mean, this is how many acres is this thing, and what is it? Tell people a little bit about this one.
It's hundreds of acres. And originally the plan was for this massive mixed use development, commercial housing. If you've driven down 95, kind of like Central Place right off 95, that massive Walmart, Target housing development right at the intersection of 95 and Highway 3.
Yeah, and if you haven't driven it, you can imagine it.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest developments I've ever seen. And they basically want to redo that, but right at the entrance to the Wilderness battlefield.
It's like almost right next to where the whole Wilderness Walmart fight was. And a lot of people probably are familiar with that one. I mean, you finally fixed that, and then this is the next thing. And, you know, to your point before, the trust not being opposed to any of this. In fact, you guys worked, I mean, it was so far back, it was almost when I was there,
right.
on this project of how could you do development
exactly.
at this site in a way that was conducive to the natural features, the water, the battlefield, existing residents, right? Because there's people who live around here.
Exactly.
So it wasn't like you were like, no way, no growth ever. In fact, you said, yes, growth. Here's mm-hmm. how it should be done. And what was the response to that? Just no?
At first, it was good. It was something that we worked with the county on to develop this gateway study on how, you know, culturally sensitive landscapes can best be used with smart development. And for a good while, I mean, the county was on board, but then this proposal came out and, you know, it appealed to the right folks and it's moved forward, unfortunately.
And it's the subject of a lawsuit now, right?
It is. And, you know, a lot of different groups that we work with, a lot of local friends groups. And like you mentioned, Nick, a lot of folks live around there. HOAs have gotten involved in this. A lot of folks are opposed to it and want to see it stopped. So we're working to try and tap the brakes on it. And just one unfortunate development, you mentioned data centers. The original plan did not call for any data centers. Well, guess what's right in the middle of this massive plan? Data centers. So if it does move forward, I don't know anyone who would want to live in a brand new development that surrounds these 120-foot tall data centers that are humming 24/7 because you need a lot of power. You need air conditioners running to keep these things cool.
Well, you wouldn't have to pay for a white noise machine, though, Paul.
Right, right.
So it could be, maybe it's a selling point. I don't know.
Right, yeah.
So if people want to learn more about these issues when it comes to this and how the trust handles it and how you balance growth and smart growth with preservation, because I think you do an interesting job of it when from a land preservation perspective and is a balanced approach. People want to learn more about this. There's presumably stuff on the website all about this.
Yeah, we have tons of information about all the different advocacy campaigns that we're working on. If you want to get involved, I mentioned our website is battlefields.org, pretty straightforward. But, you know, if you want to help us stop these threats, whether it's the Wilderness Walmart, whether it's, you know, we just worked out a threat to the Port Hudson battlefield in Louisiana, not far from where I grew up. That one seems to have abated. The power company there was trying to put some high-density power lines right through the middle of unprotected battlefield land. They've since rerouted and worked out a smarter solution. And to your point, Nick, about the Wilderness Walmart, you know, we want to see solutions. We want to see smart growth in these places. The Walmart that was proposed for this intersection right at the gateway to the Wilderness Battlefield, the agreement we worked out with Walmart, they relocated the store about 6 miles down the road. So it's there, it's used, but it's not right at the entrance to this important battlefield park. So, you know, we want to work on solutions. We don't want to just stop development cold in its tracks. But our message is, you know, you can't replace these places. You can't. There is only one Gettysburg. There is only one Wilderness battlefield. So we want to make sure that these places are preserved, interpreted, so that, you know, folks like us, Nick, when our grandkids want to go out and visit these sites that we took an interest in visiting when we were younger, it'll still be there and it'll look the same as it did when we first walked across the battlefields. And it's close to as they did when the battles took place 160 years ago.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely put links in the show notes so people can check out the website and learn about all these different campaigns and also download the manual. Before we go, I wouldn't be doing my job if I also didn't ask you, this is not a American Battlefield Trust question, but I also know you're on this unique campaign that I'm sure would appeal to many listeners to visit and photograph every national historic landmark in America. Is that fair?
It's a tall task.
How many are there, Paul?
There are, my last count, about 2,600.
And you have visited?
Just over half. So
that's a lot. You've done 1,300?
Yeah.
Now, would you be the first American to visit all of them?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't asked. The Park Service has not commented on that. But
why don't you just make that claim and then have somebody else prove you wrong?
Okay.
All right. So Paul is going to be the first American to visit all of them. When you finish that, will you come back and sure. give us like a, we probably should do a whole separate episode on this, but people can follow you on Instagram, right?
It's the handle is Exploring Historic Landmarks, pretty straightforward. And, you know, a lot of the historic sites that Preservation Maryland works on, the Monocacy Battlefield, John Brown's headquarters in Maryland, you know, Fort Frederick, all of these are National Historic Landmarks. And for me, I love the national parks. I've been to more than half of the park units in the country as well. But National Historic Landmarks, identified by the Park Service and the Department of the Interior as basically the cream of the crop of historic sites around the country. And like you said, there are 2,600 of them. This is, for me, where the most important history happens. And they're managed in a lot of cases, not by the National Park Service, but by passionate local folks. So right. it's interesting to visit these folks and get a sense of what they're doing to preserve their sites, to get folks out there, interpret them. And but yeah, I'm on a quest, I guess, to visit all of them. I have been to almost all of them in Maryland. The one that I've not made it to is the Charles Carroll home just outside Ellicott City. I'd love to go there one day.
If someone's listening and can get him exactly. out, are there any others that are just you can't seem to get into? Maybe we'll have you back and then you could put out this appeal for help to yes. get to these difficult NHLs.
Now, there are a few that are privately owned, and I definitely want to be respectful of any private homeowner. I'm not going to show up at your door and knock and ask for a tour, but you know, I they're all very interesting and historic and unique in their own way. But, you know, yeah, it's been a fun quest. You know, I've been at it for quite a while and, you know, I don't seek them out, but if I have the list up, that's where I'll start my travels.
And you're talking about Dowraigan Manor in Maryland. Yeah. So we gotta hook Paul up with Dowraigan. Well, this is awesome. The thing we do ask at the end normally makes people squirm. You have a favorite historic place or site. I'm sure you have many, but maybe what's your favorite one that you've most recently visited?
So I really like Frank Lloyd Wright sites. I know that's kind of modern American history, but it's such a,
don't tell the people at the trust that they're not. That's no, that doesn't jive. Happy. Don't Gary Edelman does not. Gary Edelman cannot. He cannot be a Frank Lloyd Wright fan. I'm not guessing it.
I understand, but I was actually up in Wisconsin, and reached out to the folks who live in Frank Lloyd Wright's first Usonian home, the kind of standard houses after he designed, like Falling Water, but the basic single family homes that he started designing. And the first one still stands in Madison and it's privately owned. And so I reached out to the owner and he welcomes folks all the time. And it's actually one of the 8 sites that make up the Frank Lloyd Wright UNESCO site around the country. So getting into that was very cool. I mean, it was very recent, but that was a highlight.
That's cool.
Everyone gets a chance. Those are really cool sites to
Frank
check out.
Lloyd Wright sites. Well, we like that. And this has been a lot of fun. We should have you back to talk about your National Historic Landmark adventure and some of your favorites and the more unique ones. We'll come up with like a rapid fire, like strangest ones, hardest ones to get to, best food nearby, stuff like that. So people can know all that and they can follow you there. They can jump on battlefields.org, find out more about all this. They can download the manual. This has been great to have you on today, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening and keep on preserving.